This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 5th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, environmentalists raise concern about ethanol as the EPA and the oil and gas industry clash over biofuels. In Mexico, campesino activists face deadly risks in their demands for rights and basic farming supplies. And a popular bike-sharing program in Buenos Aires is set to expand. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Turkey, a third person has died as protesters confront riot police in several cities. The actions have grown into some of the largest anti-government demonstrations the Republic has ever seen, with thousands of striking union members marching on Istanbul and Ankara in solidarity today. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has this update.
The Turkish government is trying to contain the unrest that's engulfed more than 40 cities. Today, the deputy prime minister met with representatives of the Taksim Platform, a group that has been vocal about the controversial redevelopment of Taksim Square. Representatives are demanding the preservation of Gezi Park and a cultural center, the banning of pepper spray, and the release of more than 3,000 protesters who have been detained. Betul Tanbay, co-founder of the Taksim Platform group, says the Turkish government needs to respect basic civil rights and drop plans to redevelop the square.
We want no violence. We want universal right for protest at the place that we chose to protest. And because Taksim represented for the whole history republic is the place where people express themselves freely.
Turkish media also reported today that 29 young people in the city of Izmir were detained for using Twitter to encourage people to join the demonstrations. Turkey's prime minister has blamed social media for inciting people to protest. He has rejected criticism of his government, which protesters say is becoming increasingly authoritarian. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
A U.S. documentary filmmaker detained in Venezuela for spying and inciting violence after the controversial presidential elections was released from prison today. Timothy Tracy was expelled from the country, according to the Venezuelan Ministry of Justice, which posted pictures on Twitter of Tracy at the airport en route to Miami. Tracy's supporters called the charges unfounded and say he was shooting a documentary about the political divide in the country. Nigeria has formally declared Boko Haram a terrorist group and issued a law to ban them. The president's office announced today the Islamist group's activities are illegal. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports.
The official declaration of Boko Haram as terrorist group means members and affiliate organizations can be prosecuted under the Terrorism Prevention Act. The law authorizes prison terms of at least 20 years for anybody supporting the group. In the past month, the government has stepped up efforts to control Boko Haram, making dozens of arrests. Earlier in the week, the U.S. government announced it was offering to pay a reward of $7 million for information leading to the capture of the sect's leader, Abubakar Shekau. Shekau is one of the five alleged Islamist militants active in northern and West Africa for whom the U.S. is offering a reward. Conflicts between the Boko Haram and government security forces have left an estimated 3,000 people dead. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
Local residents and indigenous leaders are voicing support for a bill before Nevada's governor that would lead to the decommissioning of the Reed Gardner coal-fired power plant about 50 miles northeast of Las Vegas. Vicki Simmons chairs the Moapa Band of Paiutes Environmental Committee and is also a member of the tribe's health board. She says this measure was sorely needed.
It really makes a difference that this plant be closed down because of how many years we've suffered with this pollution. For over 50 years, we can't take it as a people. We have high rates of asthma, heart and lung disease, and cancer. Our children are all suffering from asthma.
The bill calls for shutting down the plant in phases, with all generators closed by 2017. It also mandates another 350 megawatts of renewable energy for Nevada. Governor Brian Sandoval has indicated he supports the measure. Blacks in the United States are arrested for marijuana possession at much higher rates than whites, despite roughly equal usage. This, according to a new report out by the ACLU. It finds overall, blacks are more than three times more likely to be arrested for marijuana-related offenses. In Iowa, Washington, D.C., Minnesota, and Illinois, the discrepancy is more than 7.5 times. The report argues for legalization and says the $3.6 billion spent by jurisdictions enforcing marijuana laws could be better utilized. And finally, today, family and colleagues attended the New York funeral of New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg. Hillary Clinton, who served with Lautenberg in the Senate, remembered his work.
And as Frank would say, it's not where you sit that counts, it's where you stand. And there was never any doubt where he stood.
Lautenberg was the last remaining World War II veteran serving in the Senate. He was a progressive voice, challenging corporate interests on smoking regulations, oil subsidies, and co-authored the Community Right to Know Act, which requires industries to inform communities about hazardous and toxic chemicals being used at facilities. Lautenberg died Monday. He was 89. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Syria, government forces took control of most of the key town Qusair this morning after fierce battles near Lebanon's border. The fighting came as United Nations officials and U.S. and Russian representatives met in Geneva in an attempt to work out a process of political negotiation to the conflict, which has continued for more than 2 years and claimed an estimated 80,000 lives. But the talks in Geneva were suspended, according to UN Arab League Special Envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, who said there was still a lot of work to do to bring the Syrian government and the opposition together for a meeting. Brahimi said he hoped talks could start by July. The fighting continues to drive Syrians from their homes in record numbers. So far, the UN Refugee Agency has registered nearly 500,000 in Jordan. Abdul Latif, a Syrian refugee now in the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, said he fled the violence with his children when attacks increased in Daraa.
We got out of Syria with great difficulty. It took us 1 month and 4 days to cross the Jordanian border because of the bombing in Syria.
Abdul Latif said he struggles at the camp with his children, including a 15-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter, both with disabilities. His younger son stopped talking after the violence.
My son didn't start talking until he was around 2.5 years old. He started talking late, but thank God he began talking. But after the noise of the bombing and the shelling, he stopped talking altogether. It was because of the fear. He used to crawl, and now he doesn't crawl or talk.
Children are especially vulnerable to the trauma of war, and many of their basic rights are being violated in the conflict in Syria, according to a report by the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria presented at the Human Rights Council Tuesday. The report documented killings of children and injuries from sniper fire and aerial bombardment, the recruitment of children by armed groups, and what it calls a health and nutrition crisis that disproportionately affects children under 5 and nursing mothers. 3 campesino activists were found murdered in the southern Mexican state of Guerrero this week. The men had been protesting for farmers' rights and were disappeared with 5 other community leaders following an action demanding basic supplies. FSRN's Andalusia Noll has more from Mexico.
It is growing season in southern Mexico, and farmers in Iguala, Guerrero were preparing to plant their crops but lacked fertilizers. Demanding that the state government provide them with essential farming materials, members of the Popular Union of Iguala organized a protest at a toll booth on the highway outside of town on May 30th. Following the protest, 8 of the union's leaders were disappeared, and their whereabouts were unknown until a few days later, when 4 of them were able to escape their kidnappers. Their survivors said that the other 3 men, Arturo Martinez Cardona, Rafael Gandera, and Angel Roman, had been assassinated. They said they didn't know the whereabouts of the 4th. Abel Barrera is the head of the Guerrero-based human rights organization, Tlachinolan. He says the so-called war on drugs has not just taken the lives of those involved with organized crime, but also community activists.
We are talking about 3 compañeros who are social activists, defenders of the rights of campesino farmers, who are movement fighters. For example, Arturo has been working 25 to 30 years in favor of campesinos. This is very serious. It has generated an indignation in the state of Guerrero and on a national level for the manner in which they were disappeared, tortured, and executed.
The attack on these men occurred while thousands of activists in Mexico City were organizing a week of action against disappearances. Héctor Cerezo is a former political prisoner and helped organize a People's Permanent Tribunal during the week of action to document forced disappearances and extrajudicial killings.
The severity of the situation happening in Mexico concerning violations of human rights is so grave that international judges, a year ago in the introductory pre-audience of the People's Permanent Tribunal in Ciudad Juarez, when they listened to the testimonies of the victims, told us the correct term that we should use is state terrorism.
Local campesinos say police in Iguala Guerrero have not launched an investigation into these deaths. Few arrests and prosecutions have been made regarding the 25,000-plus disappearances and 70,000-plus murders that have occurred across the country in the past 6.5 years. Andrew Janal, FSRN, Mexico City.
In China, families of workers killed at a factory fire continue their calls for a thorough investigation. The fire at a poultry plant in Jilin Province Monday killed more than 100 people. Survivors said their co-workers were trapped because the company locked doors to prevent theft and unauthorized work breaks. Today, Chinese government officials promised a nationwide overhaul of workplace safety and an investigation into the deadly fire. The tragedy raises concerns about working conditions in China and the role of corruption and weak labor unions in the country. For more, we're joined by Kevin Slayton, program coordinator with China Labor Watch. He joins us from New York. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Let's start with the Baiyunfeng poultry plant in Jilin Province where the fire took place. State media said about 300 workers were at the plant when the fire began. What is known about the factory itself, where its supply goes, its history?
The information that we do have so far is that this factory, Baiyunfeng, is a poultry producer and a poultry processor that makes products mainly for domestic or almost all for domestic retailers, and that it's all around the country, according to their own introduction.
So it has. So when you say it's across the country, it has other plants across the country as well.
This I'm not sure of, okay. But I do know that according to information given by the factory, they supply to domestic retailers. So we don't have any evidence of these products going outside of China.
Some workers who survived the fire described doors being locked by the company, which prevented workers from escaping, overcrowding. One family said that their daughter, who worked at the factory, routinely worked more than 12 hours but received no overtime pay. What about the conditions at the site?
You mentioned that the fact that the doors were closed and they were locked. The factory, according to one worker, the factory would lock the doors because they were very strict about workers coming in and out, and you'd also mentioned about they were worried about theft. So they kept one door on the entire production facility open, which means that in a case like this where people had to quickly leave, there was no safe way or quick way to do this, and people were running over each other, and a lot of people just got trapped in multiple ways. Some other concerns outside of the doors being locked were the fact that workers were not really trained on safety. Then this is also a common problem in China. Training before workers start their job is kind of a it's kind of taken for granted, or workers aren't trained at all. Just this law that workers have to be trained for 24 hours before they actually start working in the manufacturing industry is not really taken seriously by a lot of factories. So workers lacked knowledge on what they should do to protect themselves, especially in the case of a fire like this. Another concern is that the factory, according to news reports, did not have somebody who was an expert on safety or somebody who was responsible for the safety within the production facility. So that would have, led to a case like this where there weren't enough measures taken. We also learned that there was a fire 3 years ago at the same factory, and if it occurred again, and even in a more tragic situation, then nothing had been done in between these 3 years to prevent another disaster. So there's all sorts of indications now that we know that there was a lot of problems with safety, and it wouldn't surprise us if there were other labor violations like overtime hours and low pay or things like this, but we don't have evidence of those other things.
You mentioned several regulations that don't seem to have been followed here, training for workers about safety, rules governing overtime pay. What are the labor laws that govern working conditions at poultry plants such as this?
Well, China has very clear labor laws, and each province might have some specific angles on this law, you know, an extra specific minimum wage or maybe an extra regulation. But in general, they follow the national labor law, which the newest version of it was published in 2008. And there's also other laws related to labor contracts and things like this. The law is very clear on keeping passageways for exit clear, and there's these things have to be followed and they have to be inspected. But implementation and regulation of these laws is one of the largest problems in China.
China does have an official Communist Party-controlled trade union. What kind of labor unions are available to workers such as those at this plant, and what kind of organizational tools do they have at their disposal?
And that's sort of the underlying problem of many issues related to labor in China. There isn't a democratic or independent labor union in China. There are labor organizations that are sort of nonprofits or civil society related organizations like ours and some related organizations within China, but they're often restricted and they can't get into the factory like a union can. And so there isn't a legitimate body that within factories that is speaking for the workers, and this prevents a lot of workers from having legitimate representation and voice when dealing with their management.
Kevin Slayton is program coordinator with China Labor Watch. He joined us to discuss calls for reform and improved working conditions in China following a factory fire earlier this week. Kevin Slayton, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for talking to me today.
Federal officials and the oil and gas industry continue to battle over fuel alternatives. Today, lawmakers heard testimony from representatives of the Environmental Protection Agency as well as the American Petroleum Institute regarding the approval of E15 fuel, a mix that is 85% gasoline and 15% ethanol. But environmental organizations say that while Americans need to transition away from fossil fuels, using more corn ethanol is not the answer. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Anna Simonton has more.
In 2005, Congress created a program to increase the amount of renewable fuels used in gasoline as a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Renewable Fuel Standard is set up to gradually increase the amount of biofuels blended into gas, including those made from corn, sugarcane, soy, and crop residues. The oil industry has been fighting the standard, suing the EPA in 2012 after it approved the use of gasoline that contains 15% corn ethanol, an increase from the previous maximum of 10%. Although the court ruled in favor of the EPA earlier this year, the American Petroleum Institute appealed the decision to the Supreme Court and this week filed a brief urging the court to accept the case. In a hearing of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, California Democrat Jackie Speier defended the renewable fuel standard and the approval of E15, saying that Congress and the EPA should not backtrack from promoting ethanol production.
Here's the problem. The oil production is going to cap, even with fracking, in very short order. So we have to be prepared with alternatives. We have oil companies that are saying they're moving in that direction. BP, for a while there, was saying beyond petroleum, although they've kind of abandoned that particular moniker today. The military, the Navy, wants to have 50% of its fuels coming from biofuel by 2020. So we cannot just dig our heads in the sand here.
The oil industry is not the only opponent of the renewable fuel standard. Environmental groups have also criticized the policy, saying that burning corn ethanol, the most prevalent type of biofuel in the United States, produces more greenhouse gas emissions over its lifetime than traditional gasoline. Ben Schreiber, with the nonprofit Friends of the Earth, says the production process is detrimental to human health and the environment.
Because this is basically highly industrialized agriculture, you have a lot more use of pesticides and herbicides. You have a lot more use of mechanized labor, a lot more use of fossil fuels in the production of those crops.
Corn ethanol is considered a conventional biofuel as opposed to advanced biofuels, which have lower emission rates. Sugarcane is one such source of fuel, and as the renewable fuel standard gradually requires more ethanol in the U.S. fuel market, producers are turning to Brazil. Friends of the Earth says that Brazilian sugarcane plantations are proliferating at the expense of indigenous populations, who are forced off of their land to make way for monocultures. In addition to representatives from the EPA and the American Petroleum Institute, Dr. Jeremy Martin with the Union of Concerned Scientists spoke before the House committee Wednesday. He acknowledged that corn ethanol has drawbacks and said that the goal should be to transition to cellulosic biofuels, which are derived from byproducts of crop production rather than the crops themselves. He says the renewable fuel standard and the use of corn ethanol are a step in the right direction.
But a longer view is necessary. You didn't build the oil industry overnight. We didn't build the corn ethanol industry overnight. And so, you know, between now and 2015, you know, we're not going to build a cellulosic biofuel industry that's the scale of the oil industry. So we need a steady path forward that allows investors the confidence to build this next industry and to create the jobs and opportunities that'll come with it.
The debate comes as lawmakers are considering legislation that would prevent corn-based biofuel from being used to meet the conditions of the renewable fuel standard. Anna Simonton, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Argentina's Buenos Aires, the number of residents in a city bike riding program has grown quickly during the past couple years. City leaders had previously said they would give $27 million to a private company to expand the program, buying 2,000 bicycles and building 170 new bike stations. But faced with two court challenges and a storm of public criticism, the mayor backpedaled. From Buenos Aires, FSRN's Eilish O'Neill has more.
Ignacio Gregorini works at an NGO close to the Argentine Congress. He lives a little over a mile away. Until recently, he always took the bus to work.
I started biking about a month ago. I found out about bike sharing, but I was a little suspicious. It didn't seem practical. But then I tried it and saw how great it is to commute by bike without traffic to arrive faster, and it's free.
Biking in the city of Buenos Aires has quadrupled over the past 2.5 years. Since the city government launched a bike-sharing program and started to build a network of protected bike lanes around the city. Now, an estimated 5,000 trips are taken daily on the city's nearly 1,000 bikes. The bikes are free to use, can be borrowed for up to 2 hours, and can be taken from and returned to any one of 28 stations. Julian Grobe, one of the founders of the NGO Bici Activistas, says bike-sharing makes a lot of sense in Buenos Aires.
The good thing about the public bikes is that people don't have to bring their own bikes on the train. And for people that live in the city, it's good because they don't generally have room in their apartments for a bicycle.
Cities around the world have come up with a number of different ways to fund and operate bike-sharing systems. In Europe, bike-sharing systems are generally run by the government and funded through advertising. In North America, some cities have programs funded by sponsors. In others, such as Los Angeles and New York, for-profit companies paid for the bikes and infrastructure. To recover the investment, they sell memberships and set hourly prices. In Washington, D.C., the government oversees the program, but a private company operates it. Dr. Susan Shaheen, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, says it's not clear which of these business models works best.
okay, so people actually really like this idea. It's spreading. It seems to be becoming, you know, a notable form of transportation mobility. Now that we've got people on board, how do we keep this going? And I suspect there's going to be a range.
Buenos Aires officials said they hope to concede the city's bike sharing program to a private company because it would be easier for a contractor to manage such a large system. But since the company would not have to put down any of its own money to fund the bicycles, critics said it would have no stake in the quality of the system. Some people were also concerned because the terms of the concession would have allowed the company to charge users after the first hour. Julian Grove of Bici Activistas says having to pay for the bikes could make them less accessible for students in the working class.
Here, if people had to register with a credit card, already a lot of people wouldn't have access. From the get-go, the system would exclude a lot of people.
Grove adds that bike sharing is already working better in Buenos Aires' northern, wealthier neighborhoods, where there are more bike stations than in the southern half of the city. In fact, making bike sharing systems available to the working class is a challenge throughout the world, says Dr. Susan Shaheen of UC Berkeley. She has specific data for four of the largest bike sharing programs in the United States and Canada.
The majority of members are between ages of 16 to 34. They're very highly educated. So about 85% of them have a bachelor's degree or higher. They tend to be very much Caucasian. So 79% of the sample is from that. And the majority make over $35,000 a year.
In 2009, less than 1% of trips in Buenos Aires were on bikes. But that's increasing following the bike sharing program and the city's network of protected bike lanes. Legislator Alejandro Bodart says in order to get even more people out of buses and cars and onto bikes, especially working class people, the city's bike sharing program should remain free.
If we're putting down cash that comes from our taxes, let's make a system that makes it easier for people to get to work. What could be better for getting a group of people to give up their cars and commute by bike than by making it easy through a public service?
Following the city's announcement that it would put the city's bikes into private hands, three city legislators and the NGO, the People's Defense Committee, presented separate court challenges to the concession. Rather than fight those challenges, the mayor backpedaled. Last Wednesday, he wrote on his Twitter feed that he doesn't want the city's bike sharing program to get caught up in the middle of political arguments. He added that the bikes are a symbol of the green city we want to construct. Instead of conceding the program to a private company, the government itself will oversee the system expansion, which officials say will be complete by May 2014. Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
On Monday, in our story on fracking in Boulder, Colorado, we incorrectly stated that county commissioners voted to end a moratorium. In fact, the moratorium automatically expires on June 10th, and the commissioners voted to ask the county staff to draft amendments to the land use plan to phase in oil and gas development. FSRN regrets the error. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Shauna Ray and Carla West. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit us online at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.